Welcome to Understanding Congress, a podcast about the first branch of government. Congress is a notoriously complex institution, and few Americans think well of it. But Congress is essential to our republic. It's a place where our pluralistic society is supposed to work out its differences and come to agreement about what our laws should be. And that is why we are here, to discuss our national legislature and to think about ways to upgrade it so it can better serve our nation. I'm your host, Kevin Kosar, and I'm a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank in Washington, D.C. The topic of this episode is, why is Congress struggling to manage the nation's finances? My guest is Representative David Schweikert of Arizona. He was first elected to Congress in 2011. Prior to that, he was a businessman, and he served in Arizona's legislature and as Maricopa County's treasurer. He's a Republican and holds a seat on the Ways and Means Committee, which writes our nation's tax policy. David also is the vice chairman of the bicameral Joint Economic Committee, and he co-chairs both the Blockchain and Telehealth Caucuses. David is passionate about economics and finance, which makes him an excellent person to ask, why is Congress struggling to manage the nation's finances? David, welcome to the podcast.
Kevin, thank you for having me.
So, what is the state of the federal budget? Do we even have one in 2024?
Well, okay, that's sort of the magic question. You have one, but it's not actually the one you want. Look, in many ways, we're just operating on the spending authorization from previous years that has just been renewed over and over. So in other words, we're funding things that were supposed to have expired out and not funding things that we were supposed to be getting ready to do. It's the absurdity of a dysfunctional Congress. And I'd love to talk to you on my theory of why we're up against that. But think of this, priorities that go back into when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker are still being funded today.
Why is that?
I actually have an overarching theory, and then we can get into the nitty-gritty of some of the chaos. There's a lack of understanding out there of just the level of financial stress that the U.S. Congress is under, the entire country is under. We play this game in the United States of, well, here's publicly borrowed money, and here's the money we're borrowing internally. We're substantially the only industrialized country that plays bookkeeping games that way. On Friday, I believe we hit an all-time record of borrowing about $92,000 a second. And so now you hit this sort of constant stress of every dime a member of Congress votes on now is on borrowed money, all defense and all non-defense discretionary. And if my math is correct, and so far I'm going to be a little braggadocio here, my joint economic economists have been more accurate than the Congressional Budget Office, we're going to borrow almost $1 trillion of Medicare into mandatory this year. So now you come back and you have these internal battles of saying, you know, you get a member who's just all excited he's going to cut spending on HHS or some agency or some part of discretionary. He's going to save $500 million. It's a lot of money. But when you're borrowing about $7.5 billion a day, many of the fights we're having are over a few hours, if not just a couple days worth of borrowing. And it's a way we can look like we're doing something because we're terrified to get in front of a camera like this and tell the American public saying 100% of borrowing from today through the next 30 years will be interest, healthcare costs, almost all Medicare. And if in 8-9 years when the Social Security Trust Fund is empty, if we backfill that.
Yeah, those are astounding numbers. I think it was on Friday you had tweeted out some numbers on the national debt, including that figure of how much we're racking up per second. If memory serves, our national debt is north of $30 trillion. Is that right?
We're about $34.3 right now, I would guess. And understand, you're going to hear apologists go out and say, well, we're only $27 trillion publicly borrowed. The absurdity of that is, so the several trillion dollars you've borrowed from Social Security, from Medicare trust funds, from the transportation trust funds, railroad retirement trust funds, it goes on and on. You have to pay back. You have to pay back with interest. And because you don't actually have enough tax receipts, you're going to borrow the money to pay back the very money you've borrowed.
That's not good. I'd be quite concerned if I had an uncle or somebody who was borrowing money to pay money that he borrowed.
Well, think about this. I only bring it up because it's my moment to sort of say, you know, for those out there in the intelligentsia in DC who were mocking my joint economic economists and myself, when about 4 or 5 months ago we were saying we're going to borrow interest will be over a trillion dollars when you do gross interest in the 2024 fiscal year. Well, as you just saw, Treasury a couple of weeks ago came back and reconfirmed that, saying, yeah, we screwed up. The numbers actually, interest will be over a trillion. What that means is Social Security is at 1,450, so 1,450 billion. Interest looks like it's going to be 1,100 billion, making interest now the second biggest spend in your federal government. Then it's Medicare, then it's defense. Defense is now number four.
Yeah, some years ago, I recall a book came out by Eugene Sterla, who's written on thought about budget matters for a very long time. And he spoke of the deficits and debt and the sort of crowding effect it can have. And he called it a loss of fiscal democracy, because you just don't have as many choices now because you're just locked in so many ways.
Brilliant. And in a weird way, what you just said goes back to your previous question. Why don't you have a rational budget? Why don't you have rational appropriations? Why can't you do rational policy? How do you do those things when you now have to go home and explain to your voters that it's waste and fraud? It's not, it's huge, but it's still small compared to what we're borrowing. Our foreign aid, all foreign aid might be 5-7 days of borrowing. Or on the left, taxing rich people more. There's a couple great papers. There's one on the Manhattan Institute website from about 3-4 months ago that talks about if you did tax maximization on everyone $400,000 and up, just maximized every tax, estate tax, income tax, just got it to the point where you got the peak tax revenue, or receipts is the proper way to say it, before it started to roll over and you start losing receipts, you get, and then adjusted for its economic effects, you might get 1.5, if you're really lucky, 2% of the entire economy. Okay, that's a lot of money. I'm going to do this partially off the top of my head, but I think so far this fiscal year, we're borrowing about 9.6% of the entire economy this year, in a year where the economy is actually pretty good. And here becomes your real intellectual crash and burn that we're not allowed to talk about. If the left's idea only gets you 1.5, 2 points, and let's be honest, for many of us on the right, where we want to cut things, we can only come up with really about 1-2 points of cuts in government, that of GDP. Yet this year, in a time of good economy, you're borrowing 9.6. Do you see a math problem?
Yeah. And I recall that paper you referenced by Brian Radel at Manhattan Institute. He's a fearless truth teller.
And it's a terrific paper because it's hard to argue with.
Yeah, he knows his stuff. And, unlike you or other legislators, he doesn't have to face voters, so he can give the unpleasant facts of the matter from his perch at Manhattan Institute. So, you know, it's interesting. Some time back, I spoke with a budget expert who reminded me that it was the habit of the U.S. government from the founding on forward, ultimately, to try to aim to have a roughly balanced budget over the long run. You know, you hit rough times, you hit a war, you hit other sort of problems. Sure, you run up the deficits, but then you turn around and make some adjustments and you get yourself back to where you're supposed to be. It's actually Paul Winfrey, who used to be at Heritage and now has his own organization. That seems to have been lost. The idea that, you know, running structural deficits, everybody seems to want to talk about them as a problem, unless you're a modern monetary theorist. But doing something? Is there any action?
Well, I'm not being disharmonious. I think it's actually gotten, in some ways, simpler than that problem. I mean, the old history is, you know, when you need a stimulus, borrow some. When times are good, pay off, you know, your sins. 100% of the debt, once again, from today to the next 30 years, is interest, and demographics is another way to say it. And we hate to talk about this because it gets you unelected, but it's truthful. We got old. There was an update in fertility numbers, I think, on Friday, which were terrifying. I think I have the number in my head. I don't know who I'm supposed to be quoting. I think we were down to 1.63% in last year's fertility rates. So now we have fertility that's equal to Western Europe and lower than France, lower than a number of the countries. The only reason I say that is my math is in about 15, 16 years, the United States has more deaths than births. Deal with the reality of we have a population that has earned benefits, our baby boomers. They earned their Medicare. They earned their Social Security. That's part of the social contract. But we don't have the population growth, the economic vitality, those to have the tax receipts to take care of that. So unless you're willing to do some things that have a change in healthcare costs, and most of the political class wants to play these games of, you know, Medicare for all or this or that. None of those actually reduce healthcare costs. What they do is they shift who pays. You know, it's subsidized here and paid over here. Instead of adoption of technology, adoption of aggressive pursuit of cures, of taking a look at very difficult, honest math. If diabetes, particularly type 2, is 33% of all healthcare spending, 31% of all Medicare, wouldn't you actually say, let's have a brutally honest conversation. What do we do in a discussion of obesity in America or a preventing diabetes? And it turns out mathematically, that's one of the first things in the stack you could do that's moral. It's great for society. It's great for family formation. It's great for being able to come back into the workforce. It's also just moral. And we actually have some math that shows it's one of the most powerful things you could do to close income inequality for urban poor, rural poor, my tribal poor here in Arizona would be to take on, you know, things that are preventable in health. 5% of the population is over 50% of the healthcare spend. Help your brothers and sisters with those chronic diseases. And the most common is obesity. And it's fascinating the attacks I will now receive for what I just told you, even though every bit of that is ethically and mathematically absolutely truthful.
Yeah, yeah. I recall seeing some of the things you put out about the, was it Ozempic, and the idea that we could have these medications that could just do miraculous things.
And I want to be careful in that area. We refer to those more as part of the thought experiment. It's obviously bigger. You know, should you actually have a brutally honest look at agriculture policy? Should you have a brutally honest conversation what we do in nutrition support in the United States? You know, in many ways, we're killing our brothers and sisters. When you look at mortality statistics of particularly the poor and then the health outcomes of that population, and then you actually take a look at what causes those health outcomes, you know, it's frustrating because the political class often wants to say, well, we'll just cut spending here. And then you lay out in front of them what your options are to cut. And they like the rhetoric. They don't actually like the facts of what would have to happen.
Yeah, I think as you alluded to earlier, frequently the magnitude of what they're pointing at is just, it's not going to make much of a difference because that's not where the real drivers of the deficit and debt are. It's in these other categories. What are we up to on the entitlements plus debt payments? Is that 65%+
of our much higher,
even
much
higher.
If you're borrowing close to 30% of your government, you know, it's actually probably even more this year, and it should be because you have a year where tax collections have grown four plus percent. Yet we actually have had months where our spend is triple that. And there's always complications. You know, we had certain deferred healthcare treatments that we had this huge spike in Medicare, and we're trying to figure out what normalization is. But if we come in this year borrowing $2.5 trillion, maybe three, if you look at some of the math, in a year when tax receipts are fairly healthy, imagine if we go into an economic slowdown. Imagine if we get into a hot war. Imagine if there's another pandemic. We've made ourselves very economically fragile from the federal borrowing debt standpoint. And one of my newest sayings is, don't worry, Congress is no longer in charge. The administration no longer is in charge. We've made the decision to put the bond market in charge of your government.
That kind of leads me to my next question, which is, it's clear that it's tough, probably tougher than maybe ever, for a legislator to tell voters the truth about how the federal finances work. And if you really want to cut deficits, it's not going to be pretty. It's going to be hard.
I want to say it'll be hard. There is hope, just that window is closing on us very fast. We've done some experiments on things you could do in health, adoption of AI, adoption of technology, shutting down programs that don't really do anything anymore. And for them to have the real fiscal effects before you've hit such a level of borrowing that the financing cost just sort of takes over everything, you may only have, you know, 4 or 5 years to make some of these decisions, maybe even less. On some of the health stuff, you need to do them in the next 36 months.
Yeah, before things get completely out of control. It's like a car going off a cliff or something. Is there anything that can be done in terms of the 74 Budget Act that would make it better or easier or less agonizing and difficult for Congress to collectively kind of make these decisions? Or is it just, we just need better people who can step up and tell the truth and make hard votes?
Brilliant question, Kevin. Brilliant question. And you and I need a whiteboard and 3 days of caffeine to sit and walk through, because believe it or not, it's remarkably complex. I actually believe in the 1974 Budget Reconciliation Act. There are a number of tools there that could be used, but you also need a structural difference on the committee structure. And this one's uncomfortable to talk about, but you have a lot of committees where health is in like four committees. So how do you move something if it's, you're trying to fix something, you know, provide certain incentives in Medicare to have keep people healthy, or to do this or do that, or to add competition, legalize the use of technology? When you think before the pandemic, things like telehealth were some of the most lobbied against technology optionality in all of Congress. And it wasn't necessarily the health estate. It was often the investors in the land underneath the urgent care center, or the Wall Street firms that had bought the emergency rooms and feared that telehealth was. So it's always about the money. Now, back to your point, if you can't redesign the areas of authority of the individual committees and do a better job then of tying the policy side to the appropriation side, because we have this disconnect now where we appropriate, but the policies are almost impossible to move things that are disruptive. So we take joy in the fact saying we did a price transparency bill, and then our own scorers and then the outside academics come back and say, yeah, it's good stuff. It's going to, over a decade, possibly bend healthcare costs by 0.5%. Yet you have in many markets a double-digit price growth on healthcare. So we pat ourselves on the back for accomplishing these tiny, tiny rounding errors because they sound great in speeches and mail pieces. But the scale of movement against us financially is overwhelming, and we're terrified to tell the truth about it. So my answer comes back to your only choice may be to put together a debt deficit commission, give it remarkable authority, give it an up or down vote in lame duck, and just accept that the people who lead it are destroying their potential political careers to save the country.
Yeah, it sounds like their membership should be recruited from people who have already announced their retirement.
And forgive me for, I speak a bit boldly, but I'm incredibly blessed. I would argue I probably have one of the best, if not the best, educated district represented by a Republican in America. And when you have a very well-educated population that's fairly prosperous, you can talk to them like adults. You don't have to do the level of pandering that goes on in so much of today's right and left politics. You know, the other day I held a forum, a women's forum, just of local business leaders. I think half the room had PhDs, which is a little intimidating. But so there's something joyful I get is because you can have these adult, very complex conversations with my constituents. I do have to accept most of the members of Congress don't have constituencies like I do.
Yeah, and is it possible that increased party competition for control of Congress, you know, control from one majority to another has gone back and forth over the last 30 years between the parties at a rate we haven't seen since the late 19th century? That also is kind of playing into this inability for many legislators to just be blunt and to take hard votes?
Yes.
Yeah.
And some of it is when you design districts of complete commonality, it makes it efficient to represent, makes it efficient to get elected. But then you find yourself only pandering to one, you know, if it's an all agriculture or it's all coastal or it's all this, you know, you basically, you know, it's like some of my friends out there who are fighting for SALT, you know, state and local tax deduction. They understand it, if you can get them in a closed door and make sure there's no microphones, it's really bad tax policy to raise up the SALT caps. It skews, it has all sorts of distortive effects, but that's what they run on. And because they have a concentration of that type of population. Look, one of the mistakes many of us make is we think it's Republican versus Democrat. These days, it's sort of Democrat versus populist versus conservatives versus this. But woven inside there is suburban versus urban, rural versus suburban, coastal versus. So there's lots of these competitions. And very few people in Congress have committee assignments where their life is to specialize in the math, to truly bathe in the numbers. So I'm one of a handful of members that, you know, everything is about how do you make the finances of the country work? And that's also a problem.
Yeah. And I suppose when, you know, like now when the economy is doing pretty well, you know, delivering bad news about federal finances is less appealing proposition. But of course, if the bond market was to suddenly get very grumpy towards the federal government, you know, the way it happened, you know, remember when President Clinton in the 90s was scared
yes.
by the bond market, that sort of exogenous shock, you know, is kind of creates the window potentially for a little more truth telling.
At that point, you may be telling the truth, but the policy options require a window of time. And there's your problem is, okay, we can run around and give great speeches. Oh, you know, we've had this sudden shock of interest rates or a failed bond auction or these things. My argument comes at that point, you're just doing triage. You didn't need to be up against that. One of the most powerful things you could do to make sure the bond market continues to like U.S. sovereign debt is demonstrate to the bond market that you're taking the accumulation of debt seriously. If we end this year, this fiscal year, at $2 trillion, $800 billion type of borrow. I think the bond market, the entire world is going to take a big sigh and look at us and sort of decide what sort of premium they want interest rate wise when they buy longer term US debt. And then there's other things going on. We don't want to geek out because you'll have only three viewers who actually, you know, care about the repo markets and what's happening there in the short term and some of the premiums being paid on the short end of the curve. But the fact of the matter is it's getting expensive out there to finance this debt.
Yeah, and that's a bad thing. All right. Last question. We are once again flirting with a partial or full-on government shutdown. I'm old enough to remember when they were fairly unusual. A, what's driving this frequency? And B, is there any change in the budget process that you would favor that would decrease this? Or is this just simply human beings not being able to come to agreement?
Okay, back to a premise we sort of started with. Yes, I could give you a half a dozen policy changes that are just sort of rules and mechanics that would really, really help avoid this sort of stupidity. But I truly believe the primary driver of the chaos is the thing we don't talk about, and that is there's no money. If every dime you as an elected official, elected member of Congress, vote on is borrowed, plus several hundred billion, maybe even a trillion this coming year of mandatory is borrowed. And then you actually have the distortion field that is social media, that is the theatrics of today's whatever it is on a post on that social media that actually is not mathematically true. One of my best examples I can give you is, you know, we functionally got rid of a speaker. We fought like crazy. And at one point, we were fighting over $16 billion. That's real money. I think on Friday, we borrowed about $3.5 billion that day. So think about that. You shut down, in many ways, you keep yourself from doing any real work on budgets and those things for several months for what equals 2 days of borrowing. And there's the distortion field, is the lack of understanding of this is honorable, it's worth fighting. But if you don't close the deal there, you don't get to work on the real drivers, the big stuff. But the little stuff is easy to sell to your political supporters. You know, you can talk about this, talk about that. It gets you on, you know, cable television tonight. But trying to talk about, you know, the demographic movement and fertility rates and what that's ultimately doing to the structural growth of U.S. debt is hard to explain. And you won't be on television doing it. And so the incentive structure also of executing a deal, putting the package together, and getting to the real work just isn't there.
Yeah, I would imagine complicated explanations are probably not the sort of thing that you want to spend a lot of time with when you are going back and running in a partisan primary.
And there's your problem. My father, and I'm embarrassed sometimes that I'm now quoting my father. It's amazing how much smarter they sound when you get older. Used to have the saying, for every complex problem, there's a simple solution. That is absolutely wrong. The fact of the matter is we have a remarkably complex problem, and it's going to require a complex solution, but there's a way to do it. But you got to be willing to think about the debt as a unified theory. You're going to have an immigration conversation, but it has to be talent-based. Importing poverty doesn't grow the economy where you need it to be when you actually add in your expenses and costs. Over here, the adoption of technology, the adoption of cures, the actual incentives to be healthy. We actually have worked out a couple dozen things. And policy-wise, you have to do them all at the same time because they all interact off of each other. And that's why I've grown to believe that our only path will be doing a very bold debt and deficit commission and the trolls will campaign against it and say crazy things. But can I give you the simplest moral argument? 8 to 9 years from now, the Social Security Trust Fund is emptied. Now, you still have the payroll tax coming in, but it means the average couple in America will take a $17,400 cut in 2033 or 2034, which is only 8, 9 years away. We will double senior poverty at that time. When we cut Social Security benefits by 25%, we will double senior poverty. We already have a problem with baby boomers becoming homeless because of housing pricing, rent pricing. We see it coming. It's not a black swan, it's a white swan. We see it coming, but we're not willing to deal with it because for the Democrats, they see it as a chance saying, if the more they wait, they can do higher taxes. Okay, but we've demonstrated that all the tax proposals of the Democrats don't even come close to covering that 25% shortfall. Is it immoral to double senior poverty in 8, 9 years from now? Of course it is. And yet, the fact I just said this on your podcast, there will be a troll out there who will now be running a attack ad because Schweiker talked about Social Security. But I'm passionate about saving it. You would think that would become communal, that would become bipartisan. But it requires math, and Congress is now a math-free zone.
Well, here's to hoping that more people who understand the math are willing to come forward and serve in the chamber and also to speak up and to speak honestly. We have to wrap it up here. Representative David Schweiker, thank you so much for giving us an honest, unvarnished, good look at the state of our budget, the state of our debt, and the possibility that with a little bit of courage and some smart thinking, we can actually fix things or make them a lot better.
Kevin, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Understanding Congress, a podcast of the American Enterprise Institute. This program was produced by Jaehun Lee and hosted by Kevin Kosar. You can subscribe to Understanding Congress via Stitcher, iTunes, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn. We hope you'll share this podcast with others and tell us what you think about it by posting your thoughts and questions on Twitter and tagging at AEI. Once again, thank you for listening and have a great day.